Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. This week, it is April the 19th of 2017. We got a bunch of different manga to talk about because, Shonen Jump's been adding some new series to their English version, and, we're gonna talk about, I think like nine different series? Nine or ten different series this week.
Yeah, about that. It's a jam-packed issue, and that's with us, not even talking about Robo X Laser Beam.
I mean, we can talk about it now. One of them shoots the ball really well, and then the other one, Robo, he gets an eagle,
which is a hole in one, basically, right?
An eagle is two below par on a hole. It's a really good shot, but it's not quite a hole in one.
I thought he got a hole in one. Maybe not.
No, he didn't. He did one approach. He did one approach, and then he did. Where did it go? He did the drive. He didn't have to do an approach. I feel like I'm in that scene in the IT crowd where they go to like, I don't even know what it was, like a soccer game.
Oh yeah.
Like just observing them. It's like, he's hit the ball. And apparently this is deserving of a round of applause. Only certain niche sports does that ever get that reaction out of me. And golf is one where I'm just like, oh God, I don't care.
Yeah, it's still one that I've had a little trouble getting into. But it is in the magazine now, which I know a lot of people are very excited about. So it's very cool to see that. I think having the prestige of being the guy who made Kuroko's No Basket is probably a good reason that this series is going to have a chance at having a substantial run. So hopefully we get a very enjoyable series. Maybe we'll grow on it. You never know. Yeah. I mean,
We'll keep up with it. It's going to be in the magazine every time we're reading it for the rest of its run. And yeah, maybe it'll get really exciting and we'll pick it up. Who knows?
Yeah.
But in the meantime, we are going to be going into our regular stuff. And we are going to be adding one to our regular read-through, I think. But we're going to start things off as we normally do, the recap portion, Weekly Manga Recap, with My Hero Academia.
Huzzah!
Yes, yeah.
If you see me looking down a lot this episode, it's because Shonen Jump's website was really difficult for me to get access to. Again, there's just a multitude of weird technical issues I cannot solve. So I'm basically reading all of Shonen Jump right now through my Kindle off to the side. So we're stopgapping this thing up and down.
So you may recall last time that Kirishima, or Red Riot, had gotten into an encounter with a guy who doped himself up on some drugs so that his blade ability was super powerful. Red Riot surpassed his limits, achieved maximum hardness, and repelled the guy's attacks. And, that's how we kick things off in this week's chapter. Number 134, Let's Go, Gutsy Red Riot. Which sounds like his theme song, doesn't it?
It's one of those phrases that, like, I think is, like, the usual kind of, like, opening in, like, an anime sort of thing. Like, you know, like, they're
Gutsy Red Riot.
Yeah, like, you know, there were, like, openings in Pokemon. It's like, Pikachu, a fiery, or a quick electric fire starter, or something like that. Right. And then when it came over to America, it was like, Pikachu, your nose! It's like, that's not even a good pun. Whatever. That's what I read when I see it. Let's go, Gutsy Red Riot.
There's Pikachu, your nose.
Yeah.
So I can just imagine like someone's being like, you mean like picking your nose, right? No, chewing your nose. That's a thing, right?
Yeah. Pikachu in your nose. Don't look at me like I'm the crazy one.
You guys don't chew on people's noses.
Oh.
Okay.
I'll just show myself out. I'll just hurl myself out this window so we can end this awkwardness.
Don't look in this red and fleshy Ziploc bag I've got.
I assumed it was okay to take them as well. I think there's a lot of things I've been assuming that now aren't actually legal. Are you allowed to just take things that don't belong to you because you want them?
Especially
stealing,
off of
you say. Larceny, you say, oh my.
So, the bladed guy focuses his abilities so that all the blades, instead of going on every direction, they kind of shoot out in this long column of focused fire. And so Kirishima has to meet it head on. And so, you know, he's just maintaining his focus, and he's like, that's right, I'm the Harney Man. No parlor tricks, just a bulldozer. I'll overwhelm him. And he uses his ultimate move, Red Gun Turret, which is a punch. But it's a cool punch. It looks good.
Well, I mean, he explains it. Like, he's not flashy. He is meant to be a bulldozer. So his special attack, in fairness, shouldn't be flashy. It should just be him like, I'm next to you now. Kablam!
I also really like the way he's gritting his teeth, but he's you know, got the weird shark teeth. So it just looks really cool with his as he punches him.
It is a pretty cool shot.
So Kirishima is able to defeat the guy.
I guess just
as he reaches his limit, he has kind of exhausted his stamina, to use the hardening.
I guess he's doing essentially like the Toriko nail gun punch, because there's multiple sound effects of wham. So I guess it's multiple shots.
I guess you're right.
Hard
yeah,
to there tell.
Maybe it's an echo, like wham, wham, wham.
Maybe.
But yeah, he punches the guy really hard. Knocks him on his ass, and the guy's like, all I want to do is get stronger. You should let me go. I'm pathetic, and I want a taste of power. And Kirishima says, no, sorry, you shot my senpai. I get how you feel, though. See, a while back, the guy's just like, I don't give a crap! He just uses his blade ability to launch himself away. He's like, I don't want to hear your soft story.
He's like, laters! Zoinks!
I did think that was really funny when I first read it. It's the, yeah, the guy's like, oh, you should feel sorry for me because I'm pathetic. And Kirishima's like, oh, I have my own shortcomings that I feel bad about too. No, I want to hear it!
It's like every other character, because he kind of gets admonished a little bit for this afterwards, when you're like, every other character in this series would have done the exact same fucking thing that he did. Yeah, really? Like, they would have been like, hold on, let me get a personal connection going on here with this villain.
Yeah, you would totally have gotten tricked by this guy, absolutely. The only one who wouldn't have fallen for it would have been Bakugo.
Yeah. Although I think Bakugo would have been really bad in this fight, because then there would just been explosive shrapnel flying in every direction.
I beat the guy by causing even more damage to the buildings.
Even more people suffered because of me.
But I stopped him.
Yeah.
Praise me! So the guy uses his blades to vault himself past Kirishima and tries to escape down the alleyway past him, but Fat Gum appears and cuts him off and just absorbs him into his body. And we get a quick explanation of his quirk, which is pretty much what we kind of expected it was, which was just he can absorb anything into his body. So,
here you go. It's a little bit more, I don't know what I want to say, if it's powerful or just it seems a little bit more interesting than my normal, like the notion that he's just like, oh, he's like the blob, he's fat and strong and like it's tough to hurt him, like things just bounce off. This seems to almost indicate that he's kind of like Kirby but without the inhaling part, like he could just put things inside of him and just like get in here, get inside of me, just shove people in there.
Yeah, it's good. It would have a lot of utility to it because, you know, he uses it in a suppressing way in this chapter, but you gotta imagine that he would also be able to protect people by doing that. But, oh, you know, get yourself inside my body and I'll heal you. Mm-hmm. Not heal you, but defend you that
yeah,
way, shield
I'll
you.
Protect you, yeah. He's like Tom Kench from League of Legends, Nick. He's the fish guy.
Yeah. That guy's, God, that's such an awkward character.
I love him because he's just like a Southern Bayou dude, which I've been using up and down as like the background music in a D&D campaign I've been writing. I essentially made Bray Wyatt a major villain in the campaign for a little period.
Oh, so what they did was they ignored all of his spells and hit him with one move and beat him. Gotcha.
I'm not going to lie. They have been nothing but annoyed by all of my cryptic statements as him. Have not.
Let me tell you something, man.
And their plan is to just sneak into his room at night and kill him now. Little do they know.
I am the god of this world. Now, not saying anything.
That's
I like the way you're saying. I like the way you're saying it, but you're not saying anything.
Yeah, that's intentionally what I'm doing too.
You think you know me, but you don't, man.
Are you one of the seven swords? I have many names. One might be of the seven sword. One might be what you want to call me. I am a shadow on the wall.
It's like, God fucking damn, I hate this guy.
I've associated myself with the seven swords, but I'm much more than that.
Look, back
at choose not to die myself by old labels. Oh, God.
It's good times.
Round in circles for 20 minutes at a time.
It's good times.
Alright. So, Kirishima gets praised by a fair number of the onlookers. Yeah, you did a really good job of stopping him. But, it comes at the same time where Fat Gum is kind of lecturing him. Well, actually, Fat Gum is lecturing Kirishima as he's dealing with the guy. As, you know, the guy's absorbed into his body, and you can see, like, the spikes are trying to protrude out of him, but they're stopped cold. And Feckham's like, ah, you know, even if the enemy can win if he gets away from you, if he beats you, all sorts of different ways, whereas we only have one route to victory, which is to capture the villain before he can cause harm. So, no matter what, when you fight them, make sure they lose the will to fight. That's everything. So, he did a good job, but he didn't finish the job, and that's what's most essential to being a hero. So, Fat Gum being a pretty good teacher here, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even Fat Gum does give him a little bit of praise afterwards, like, you know, you'd had a much better debut than I did, and you're going to be a great hero one day, so.
And they specifically note different people come up to essentially thank him for the fact that he protected them. So,
yeah.
It's a good moment for Kirishima.
Yeah. So afterwards, Sun Eater and Kirishima and Fat Gum are discussing the quirk booster drug that was used. And they also are talking about, oh, you know, there's the dart that was fired into Sun Eater. And the perp's gun, his quirk shredded it to scraps, and there are no bullets. We can tell it's no ordinary piece, though, so we'll get back with a report. So... Sun Eater, of course, is really upset. He's like, oh, man, this really sucks. You know, I was stopped from using my quirk, and, you had to be the one to save me and stuff. And Kirishima says, hey, you're like sunlight to me, senpai, guiding me through this work study and all. And, I like the way that Sun Eater is, like, he's got his badass hood, which is just like, don't look at me. we time skip to the next day where Kirishima is back at the dorms and, Kaminari is like, oh man, you're all over the news, Kirishima, you got this big debut. And Ashido shows a similar story for Suyu and Uraraka. Nobody saw Deku, fuck him.
To be fair, he didn't do anything except for
he didn't do anything.
Watch a little girl who seemed in distress go away.
He almost saved a little girl, but then didn't.
Yeah.
He would have probably gotten in the news for that one.
Nearly died, I think, was his most notable accomplishment in that interaction.
There's a little bit of discussion between the students for a bit, but nothing really important happens. A few days later, all the people who are, you know, are part of hero departments now head out of the dorms and they go to the station. And as things are going along, they're just kind of like, huh, we're all getting off the same station. Oh, we're going in the same direction from the station and we're turning the same corner. And here's all three of our senpais and we're going to the same building. Okay. I guess we're going to the same place. Do, 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 do. It's a really big meetup, with people from the three different hero agencies, as well as Gran Torino and, Aizawa. So, they've all been gathered together by Sir Night Eye, who says that, they are going to discuss, the Shie Hasekai organization, and he's going to share with them everything that they know. So that's it.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited to see what happens when we see like the interactions between these three companies. We've seen a good portion of what Night Eye's group is like, and we know a good bit about Fat Gum's group. Mm-hmm. But I can't remember her name. I think it was like Ryoga or something like that, the dragon lady.
Ryukyu.
We still don't know too much about her, and it looks like Sir Nida, or not Sir Nida, Fat Gum and her both brought somebody we haven't met yet from their agencies as well.
Right, yeah.
So there's room to kind of get introduced to some new characters and just see how the Big Three react, and hopefully find out whether or not Sun Eater still has his powers or not, because it's still kind of unclear if he lost them temporarily or if he's lost them for good. So hopefully we get some follow-up on that. And most importantly, I am excited at the idea that we are going to finally find out what the fuck happened at the meeting between Shigaraki and Overhaul.
Seriously. Yeah, pretty good chapter. It was kind of oddly paced because you get this big action scene at the beginning and then kind of a whole lot of nothing until they actually are at the meeting. It seems like, I don't know. It just kind of, there's just several pages where it's like, okay, and they're there. But, I'm like interested in seeing what's going to happen next. And I did really like the little diversion that we had where we followed Kirishima on his debut.
It was fun.
Okay.
All right. So, I believe it's Fairy Tail next.
Yes.
Fairy Tail, chapter 531, Pegasus versus the Blue Dragon.
Black Dragon.
I meant to say black. You know what? Fuck it. Doesn't matter what color it is. I don't see color, Nick. Stop being racist. So, oh. Actalogia is chasing after the Blue Pegasus' ship. And the first time I read through this, I guess I just become so inundated with Fairy Tail's stupidity when it comes to fan service that I just didn't even register the female member of Blue Pegasus's first response to battle against Acrylogia is, maybe I should strip.
And I look this character up because I don't even fucking remember her.
She's the model who had a modeling match against Mira Jane back in the Grand Wizard Tournament and had Jenny? To pose naked for the fucking magazine. And that's, I feel like she's not done anything else of real significance. She pops up now and then, but I don't know why. There's a small part of me that does find it hilarious that one member of the team had to specifically note, like, according to my data and logic, that seems like a stupid idea. Like, as though just hearing it weren't enough. He's like, well, based on prior experience where no one who's ever done this has succeeded, that nowhere in the history of time has anyone thought this was an effective strategy to combat an intimidating opponent. Although, it did beat Jacob, the assassin, so maybe there is a precedent for it. Essentially, they just kind of have a little bit of a talk between Wendy and Anna, and while this is kind of going on, they close in on the gap of space-time. If you remember, it's no bigger than an orange, so, and you can't see it.
Or a tangerine.
Or the size of a tangerine. And you can't see it, so you kind of just have to know where it is and avoid it. So, the ship does do specifically a barrel roll. I'm hoping that's just an in-joke at our side.
See your R twice!
Shut up, Peppy! Fox, get these things off me! Don't fuck yourself, Slippy! You help yourself out of this problem!
I'm not gonna shoot down three ships. Why do you get three? You suck!
Stop instigating shit! You always blow! You never come and help me!
But you need me to analyze the boss's health!
No, oh, I don't! I'll just keep shooting it until it dies!
So, they make that turn. They avoid it. Acnologia flies right into it. There's even a moment where we see it like a flash and this huge light shines out and everyone's like, yeah, we did it! The ship, the dragon's dead! And it's just like, raw, give me your ship! And they're all like, what happened? It just passed right through the space-time. Cut away. And Zeref's like, so I found the space-time. And let me tell you guys something interesting. Totes closed it. I made sure no one could go into it. And this
why?
And this timing is just hysterical. I didn't know they were going to do it. But man... Perfect.
What a bother! say? He says, it's brimming with so much time magic, it beggars the imagination. And that time magic belongs to me. So I sealed it up. I'll only open it for you. Why, Mark?
I guess the notion's like, even though it's the size of a tangerine and invisible, he's like, that's not enough precautions. I'll seal it closed.
Why, though?
But it is weird because that would have eliminated one of his biggest threats.
Why bother? Is this like those idiots who are just like, we can't put up windmills in order to gain energy from the wind? That'll make the wind go away.
I don't know.
We can't put on solar panels, then the sun will go out.
We'll absorb too much of the sun and then
too much
be
solar
cold.
Energy will be absorbed up by the solar panels. That's bad. Like, it's fucking a black hole of time magic and you're worried about shit being absorbed into it? Like, what the fuck?
Or people trying to take it from him? I don't know.
Maybe that's it. Maybe there's a way to absorb the time magic somehow from it, I guess.
That's the only thing I could think of.
But he doesn't say that. So you're just sort of meant to assume how this infinite supply of time magic or what the fuck ever is supposed to work. And I understand, yes, this needed to happen so that their plan to get rid of Acnologia like that would not work. But why did Zero do this? It belongs to me!
No, says the man in Washington, it belongs to the government.
It belongs to the people.
So, basically, Acnologia is tearing the shit out of their ship. So, Urza tells Perfume Guy to shatter whatever thing makes it so Dragon Slayers don't get nauseous. And I guess, though Acnologia is a dragon himself because he also has Dragon Slayer magic, he gets sick. And
ever since this was turned into the canon of Dragon Slayers, it has been a stupid thing.
It still has no actual logic behind, like, there's no in-universe explanation for it, to my knowledge.
Natsu would get motion sick. And then it turned into, he's on a boat, therefore he is sick. And ever since this has turned into all Dragon Slayers get this way, it's always been stupid. It has never made sense.
It's weird, because if you start to think about
I'll say that every single time it comes up. It's always stupid.
What's the threshold? Like, if he's, like, getting a piggyback ride from Usain Bolt, is that too, like, is it a speed thing?
Cause if he's wearing shoes, is he okay? But then if the shoes become roller skates because you put wheels on them, then does it become a method of transportation?
Like, if he's falling and, like, opens a parachute, is that considered a mode of transportation? And
is a horse a vehicle?
These are a lot of really good questions that I don't know if we're ever going to get answered. Because this is a really weird, stupid part of the fairy tale canon.
If he is having sex.
And he is.
And he is riding someone.
He is going to town.
He's riding on their ass. Does that mean that he will get motion sick?
I'm curious what he's riding on. I know there's some.
He could be gay. You don't know.
I'm going to say there's probably some yaoi fan fiction out there that works.
Probably.
Possibly. I'm not going to go out there and say there is.
Definitively.
But I am curious. I almost, in my mind, I imagine, because, like...
You know that Heroes thought of this. Look at all the... Well, no, he hasn't, because he only thinks of this stuff when it comes to the women in the series.
Like, in my mind, I imagine, like, if this were Luffy, like, you'd see the screen just from, like, you know, like, the top part of it, like, it looks like Luffy's fucking something, and then it would zoom out, and you could see it's just a pile of meat he's digging into. I don't know what it'd be for Natsu. I guess it would just be a small house fire that he's fucking. That's the only thing I can think of.
Oh my god.
So, Lucy and Gray are still sitting on this fucking park bench. God damn it, this shit is taking forever. I just realized it's like 4 fucking weeks that
Maybe we should open it. Yeah, let's open it. Maybe we should open it. Yeah, let's open it. Maybe we should open it.
That I have sat here and they have just been discussing Natsu in this fucking book. They finally open it. Letters shoot out. Lucy's like, what is that about? are these? And then cut away, because we can't get that answer. We need a fifth fucking week of the fucking park bench in the book. Natsu is fighting
Zero. My mama always said.
They're just like shitty Chinese riddles. What part of the fish weighs the most? She's like, it has to be the bones. Bones weigh so much. Gray just slaps her like, no, you idiot, the scales. She's like, that doesn't make any sense.
Why would it be the same pun in Chinese and in English?
Gray, you're dumb. You're dumb and stupid. So Natsu is losing this fight against Xerath, it seems. It's still not clear which way it's going, but he seems to be the one on the rougher end of things. Mavis shows up and is like, Xerath. And he's like, sweet, all my plan has come together. And Natsu's like, first master, back off, because I'm getting all fired up. And we can start seeing scales, draconic scales start to appear along Natsu's forehead and underneath his eyes as he is, I guess, possibly going to turn into a dragon? I don't know.
I think that he's unleashing dragon force? I don't know.
This is something different. Xerath specifically says dragon power, so I guess this is a different one.
Look, man, I believe there comes a time when everything just falls in line. We live and learn from our mistakes. The deepest cuts are healed by faith.
Living on the edge of tomorrow.
Today.
You'll always find your way. All right. So yeah, that was a fairy tale this week. Fairy tale's not very good when it doesn't set its attention towards one thing. Because when it jumps around, it tends to feel like a lot of things just don't happen. I feel like the most, like, significant portion of this story was obviously, like, Actalogia's whole portion. And outside of that, we still had to cut over to Natsu's part, to Gray and Gray and Lucy on the bus. There's a whole bit at the beginning with Lucy talking to Anna. And it's just all different parts. We're just like, I just don't care. Like, can we just focus on moving things forward? Like, I can tell there's
it was much more coherent and easy to get into when it was going through Irene's backstory, wasn't it?
Yeah, because even
and like it definitely wasn't perfect, but you could be like, okay, this is what's going on. You know?
At least those two, it's 1 week where you're like, man, this was a dumb chapter, and then it's over. Like, whereas this is essentially being drawn out over a month plus because we just. Like, we just aren't actually getting the conclusion to anything. We just keep getting more stupid side parts. It's not awful, but it is definitely just like, let's go. I need to get somewhere else.
All right. Let's shift gears and head over to Astro Lost in Space, Chapter 29. Last time, while stranded on the new planet, the crew of the Astra came across another Astra hidden behind a rock. It's a big rock. So, Kanata and Zack and Ulgar, go inside of the new ship to go and check it out. And, they're observing the place, the fact that it's quite trashed. A big detail that they see is that, there are cracks going through the hull just everywhere. So the thing is completely, broken apart, completely worthless. They're not gonna be able to use it to fly away. But they do observe that the ship actually has power. Which is an important finding. And, so they look around the place. Zack, of course, concludes, the same thing must have happened to the crew of this ship that happened to us. They flew through the atmosphere, crash landed the same as we did. So, Kanata concludes, okay, well, then maybe, they came to survey the planet, they crash landed, they called for help, and they got rescued and just left the damn ship behind. But Zack says, no, there's a message here, because he's at the console on the bridge and says, help me. And so they're like, oh, well, so then they weren't rescued, but we didn't find any crew and we didn't find any bodies. And Zack's like, the cryostasis pods, which of course is why they were brought up while they're on this planet. And, it looks as though, essentially someone used Zack's idea 12 years before he thought of it. There's a cryostasis pod that is occupied, Kanata says, okay, let's wake him up. It opens up to reveal the most fan service in this series so far. Like, seriously.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, you do see some nipples. I guess it's because, like, is that like a leotard? She's wearing this.
It's almost like a one piece swimsuit.
Yeah. In my mind, I didn't even recognize that. I just assumed it was another one of like the spacesuits because they all are like form fitting anyway. So I just didn't even register it.
Well, presumably it's what you wear when you go in the cryostasis pod because it's like filled with.
I mean, I just wear a t-shirt, you know, like maybe a classic Golden Girls t-shirt. You can't see it. I'm wearing a Golden Girls t-shirt. I'm gonna like put my new thing. I've really started to scare my D&D players because I told them I'm going to communicate you with you guys via Golden Girls gifts for the next couple weeks. And I have.
All right. I believe that we are meant to understand that this woman that they find is a fallen adult woman because they say it's a woman. And also her face is drawn so that it doesn't look quite as... It doesn't look quite as youthful as Ares and the other girls to me. I'm not sure if you got that impression.
There seems to be more maturity. I see a similarity with it, though, between her and the one character, the singer.
Yunhua.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that maturity in them, I think probably because those are two of the more mature female characters in the series. But yeah, I definitely think you're supposed to get the impression she's a little bit older.
Especially because, you know, she was like, she says later that she was actually like a crew member on an exploration ship. And normally that wouldn't be random teenagers who are going to a space academy high school. So.
Yeah. I'm very curious to essentially find out why. She is, though. I know we haven't actually gotten to the end of the chapter, but, yeah. You know, they noted last time, as you mentioned, this was brought up with, Kitori, and it was, you know, something that she, like, when it was suggested to her, was like, absolutely not. Why would you suggest it? It's such a cruel thing to do. And it's like, well, someone did, and I'm sure that situation probably wasn't identical to this one, where it's like, hey, we're like 12 teenagers who just desperately need each other to survive. But it is still one of those things, like, I wonder why her, you know?
So, they care for the woman for a little bit. Time passes, you know, she rests up on the Astra, and then Ares, when she wakes up, takes her to the lounge to meet with the rest of the crew. There's this kind of awkward panel.
I'm going to pause you right now, Nick. We find out her name. You can't argue this. She is Russian voice.
Okay. All right. Sure. So there's an awkward panel where because the woman is still weak, Ares is just kind of carting her around on a hover car, just
a hover trolley. Like it's like she's luggage.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Not that luggage.
Oh, let's go, everybody.
Say something racist and Paul has to leave out.
It's Trump's America. It's his luggage. Time to show it is.
Puts on the hat. So, the woman starts to tell her story and introduces herself as, I am an astronaut. My name is Paulina Levinskaya. And I was a crew member on the Ark 6.
She's got that intensity that I feel like that voice fits for, you know?
Yeah, and especially when it zooms in on her face and that bit last bit, like, because when they first found her, she was, you know, broken down and very emotional. Now she seems much more cold and distant now that she's had some time to recover.
It's weird. So. It's like I'm kind of placing that face on her throughout her entire part in this. Like I'm like, this is what her personality would be like. So even though we see her in her weakened state before, I just assume that's who she is. And I find her less intimidating now because she happens to be wearing like clothes and it's like a fucking t-shirt
a pop.
with a fucking monkey on a crown. It just looks like someone got this. They're like, so this was left over from a Forever 21 sale. I got it for $3. It's all I have. Like, you just, like, this is all you get. So she's just like, it will do. It is better than potato sack.
I am curious because clearly what's going to be coming next is that she's going to be telling her story, and presumably the crew of the Astra is going to try to come up with some way for them to get off of this planet. I am curious how long Paulina is going to stick around, if something is going to potentially happen to her. Because, I don't know, it feels kind of weird because we've gotten to know this fairly sizable cast. They've all been tightly knit, but they've all been around since the beginning, and so to add a new member to this ship, I don't know. It seems like it'd be kind of weird at this point.
It might be. It almost kind of might be nice to get a fresh element of things, because we've kind of gone through and seen everyone's little side of their story. So the idea of putting someone new does provide a new opportunity to tell certain stories, and maybe this does give the story a different direction to go in, based on what we find out with this Astra, like what its fate was, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, she does present an opportunity to have a different kind of storytelling, not gimmick, but hook here, because she is not a part of the original crew. She is not one of the kids. She's an adult. She's someone who has been introduced just now. We've kind of come to accept that we're probably not going to see any of the kids die, at least not in any, like, random kind of thing. Like, oh, right. No, the alien life is so dangerous here. But this is a character who has potentially, at least as of right now, a bit more of a disposable kind of lifespan to her. So maybe this could be someone who they kill. Maybe this is someone who that potential sabotager actually gets rid of. Maybe she herself is untrustworthy. You know, there's a lot of different angles they could take this. Maybe she becomes an antagonist. There's a lot of angles they can go with her.
Maybe
so it's,
he tries to, like, say that, hey, I should be taken over. I'm the only one here who is actually, like, a professional astronaut.
Yeah, so it there's a lot of different places it can go, and I'm kind of just excited to have that new element. It is weird that Astra, for a monthly series, still only gets, like, 19 pages. It does, like, I feel like I get so little each time, and I'm just like, no, one more page.
It's not monthly.
I guess it is, like, bi-weekly-ish.
It's got an odd schedule, but it's not monthly.
Yeah, it's not totally monthly, I suppose. But it is weird enough that I feel like it always ends one page before I'm ready for it to end.
No, don't go yet!
Like, I want, like, one more piece of dialogue, and they're just like, no. Niet!
Alright. Let's move on to Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 211, Absolute Judges. So there's kind of a weird... Food Wars sometimes has weird, like, use of flashbacks. Like, stuff happens in such a, you know, condensed area that when it goes back, sometimes you don't really... It doesn't really feel like it's actually going backwards. So we get the, you know, black panel outlines indicating this is a flashback. And then it's like, did this really go back in time? Are you sure?
Where am I? Who am I?
Yeah. Oh, what year is it?
Get out of my house. I'm scared. So,
essentially, the flashback is going over what Soma's been up to in preparing his dish. And yeah, you know, occasionally he's doing stuff and they're like, what the fuck is he doing? The big thing that is going on is that he is frying his noodles. And, you know, Yoshino is like, why is he frying them? And Alice is like, is that like a bad thing? And she's like, he's making yakisoba, so duh, of course you fry them. I don't know, there's something different about the noodles, I guess.
It's the buckwheat percentage, Nick, is like all buckwheat off the charts, and come on now, this is standard for yakisoba noodles. Yakisoba.
Aaron says that normally when you make yakisoba like that, you use different noodles. Whatever. The judges, it's time to introduce them. Those three judges that we had a little bit of an allusion to earlier on suddenly show up. First one is this girl who's got this weird hair clip. And she
Nick,
kind
please.
Of
please. She just happens to be an X-Man. This is like her communicator.
Wow.
This is her communicator. You know, like Cyclops had his on his chest. Yeah, like she just has hers, like, boom. Because remember, like fucking Storm, I feel like, had hers on her tits, which I feel was, like,
she
inappropriate.
Did. She did.
So
she
did. Instead, yep. She's like, well, that's just weird. I'm going to put mine
on my forehead.
So, like, if I fall down and I'm hurt, I don't have to, like, move my hand up there. I can just be like, Professor, send out. I hurt myself.
Oh, man. So, she's carrying a huge stack of books with her. And, she kind of staggers over to Soma Station. And Soma's like, you okay? Because I'm kind of trying to cook here. Fucking love that reaction.
He's like, you know.
I'm not going to help you. I just want to make sure you're okay so I don't feel bad about not helping you.
I wonder if it's even that she has. I wonder if he's just like, are you okay? Because if you are, get away because I'm trying to cook. Like, I don't even think he's trying to, like, show, like, sympathy. I think he's just like, what's going on? You're not going to, like, spit in my food, are you?
You're not going to try and sabotage me, are you?
You're not going to start throwing feces, are you?
You're not going to try and distract me with your lady bits, are you?
She's like, little do you know my mutant power to make all soba noodles taste like vomit. How did you become an X-Man with that power? She's like, Magneto really is taking a liking to soba noodles, so I kind of, I'm on the team just to fuck with him.
You know, I'm like Darwin in First Class. You know, I can't die. Dies.
No!
No, guy, we barely
our knew. One black character! The one character of color on this team!
I'm okay. Oh, man. It seems like a character from the comics. With an awesome power. And guess what? He doesn't die right away. He does die through some sort of... I don't think... If I remember correctly, like, he's, like, encased in, like, volcanic ash or some shit like that. So he doesn't die, but he's kind of irretrievably incapacitated.
I thought they, like, overloaded him, essentially. He kept changing to try to survive what was happening, and it, like, came too fast, and I figured, like, he overloaded and died.
So... You know, a limit to it, but instead of just like, I put an explosion inside you. Good luck adapting to that. But I adapt to everything. You saw me adapt to something crazy before. What bullshit is this?
Yeah, it's like,
apparently Havoc could have just shot him and he would have died.
Apparently that's all it needs to be. It's, the X-Men movies have started to gain that as they've continued on, where it's like this weird notion of just like, the silliness has almost forgotten like something very large. Like, if you watch, what was the most recent one? Apocalypse.
Uh-huh. I haven't seen that.
Well, there's the very important scene where, of course, Quicksilver runs throughout the fucking building, saving everybody because they were like,
yeah,
this one, it's different this time. It's a different song. I can't remember.
No, that's,
oh, yeah. In the second one it was, I guess. Yeah, that's what they used this time.
Yes.
So, yeah, because the first one was Time in the Bottle. So, This time, he's going through, and he has all of his little fucking jokes. He, like, eats someone's slice of pizza. He goes in and saves a dog. All that stuff. And then at the end, fucking, Cyclops is like, hey, where's my brother? Kaboom! And it's like, yeah, dickhead. Maybe if you hadn't spent so much time fucking dicking around with the ceiling shit, you might have seen that Havoc was getting incinerated over there and saved him. You basically have the power to stop time in this interpretation, but we basically just watched you dance around as Cyclops' brother got evaporated.
Anyway, I've got to go and promote a TV.
Goodbye, everybody.
This was my one scene until I come back later to decide not to to reveal myself to be Magneto's son. Bye!
At the end of this movie, Nick, he's an X-Men.
Okay.
For the sequel that I don't know if has happening yet. They haven't announced it.
Oh, man. It's like, I'm an X-Man now, which means my power had better take a really huge hit because I literally can show up only when it's convenient. Otherwise, I break everything, because I'm the Flash, basically.
He is stupidly overpowered.
He's ridiculously overpowered. He's got so much time to do fucking everything in that interpretation.
Like, there's literally a point where he's just like, he like stops and just like watching a bullet, like, Like, you see him, like, run off, like, with a movie ticket in hand, comes back with an empty bag of popcorn. He's just like, ugh!
I said the movie at 5 billion times speed. All right. Getting back into it. So, Marui, the geeky guy in Polaris who never does fucking anything, has a bit of a foamy mouth guy moment because he sees that, the books that she's carrying are the WGO Taste Evaluation Book. And he's like, they're WGO adjudicators. WGO, the World Gourmet Organization. It evaluates gourmet restaurants. And, it's got rankings and stuff. It's very important. They're very important. They're very important. They're very important.
Very.
And, they award restaurants from 1 to 3 stars because 4 stars would be too much to keep track of. I don't know.
Well, you don't want to go too many stars. It starts to lose meaning after a while.
Restaurants have a star rating system that is not 1 to 3.
Yeah, but you don't want it to become like Dance Dance Revolution where you have like S++ and you're just like, I don't even care. Like, what does this even matter anymore?
So someone does recall like, oh yeah, right. Shinomiya was trying to get a 3-star designation. So this must be what he was talking about. Yeah. And the WGO book that they're talking about is like, oh, yes, the book contains both the organization's guidelines and the list of all starred restaurants. It is simply known as the book. And the adjudicators tasked with evaluating each restaurant in person are called bookers.
Oh, Nick. The Michelin star ranking, which is the real ranking this is based off of, is a 3-star system.
Really?
Really.
Okay, then. I stand corrected.
And somehow the Michelin people, the fucking tire people, are the ones who are the go-to knowledge when it comes to food. I think solely because they're the ones who created those old-ass travel guides and food reviews were a part of that.
Huh. Okay, then. Just something that stuck around.
Hold on. I just got to note this. I'm on Wikipedia. According to the guide, 1-star signifies, quote, a very good restaurant. 2 stars signifies, quote, excellent cooking that is worth a detour. And 3 stars means, quote, exceptional cuisine that is worthy of a special journey.
Those all mean the same thing!
I think I'm more just noted of, like, why that terminology, worthy of a special journey? Like,
are you gonna fuck it?
It's like, could you, like, did fucking R.R. Tolkien write this one?
This is the most sexual episode of Weekly Manga Recap. We have had something that talk about sex in every series.
Well, it's definitely not gonna come up during We Never Learn, Nick. There's nothing sexual.
No, absolutely not.
Nothing sexual there.
Nothing, especially not the character who gets introduced. Anyway, so we're introduced to these 3 judges that we have, who are Headband Girl, Une, a first-class adjudicator, Charm, who is a snooty-looking guy in a suit jacket, and Histoire. Oh my god, this guy.
I wish
Holy shit.
I could pull off the checkered pattern plaid shirt, like full suit with a busy tie and a high top haircut.
And you just know that this guy pulls everyone that he wants. Like,
with round rimmed glasses on top of this dude is all for it, man. This
just exuding confidence, like a ridiculous. Oh man. So Une takes notice of someone like, oh hey, you know, you can hear a family restaurant written on your shirt, right? And she looks through the book. She closes the book and she's like, well, there's no reason to be disheartened yet. And there's even a caption that pops up that says pitying glance. And she goes on this whole speech, like, oh yeah, there are many who state that a restaurant not in the book is no restaurant at all, and that may be true, but just because a restaurant is not in the book, oh, you know, it's important to encourage chefs to work hard so that maybe someday their name can be inked on these hallowed pages, and your name may not yet grace the pages of the book, but you know, you yet live and breathe, and that's something. So be thankful, respect your parents for birthing you. And so it's just like, what the fuck? Well, this one, it, I'm not really sure how to take all that. I really like this character because she's, it's like she's got this speech prepared where it's almost like she doesn't really believe what she, the bullshit that she's saying.
It's just like this condescending thing that she's like, I'm doing a good deed. I'm telling him to keep trying.
I'm telling him to keep it up.
He's
even
not
though his life is worthless. And there's no reason for him to go on.
It's like, aww.
And so was like, kind of just jying over to the people in the cell. Is it really a good idea to have someone like that be a judge? They're like, ah, you be quiet. No, Yoshino, don't be a moron. No, someone, don't be a moron. And then all the people in the crowd are like, yeah, you shot someone, you can hear. How dare you? There's no way that you'll ever impress these elite judges. And Une is like, quiet. And there is a pretty cool little bit where it was this full page spread, which is just her in the foreground and the crowd of people who were jeering, and they're kind of frozen in mid-jeer, completely quiet. It's a cool little visual. So Une says, yes, I was mocking, offering words of encouragement in relation to Zero Star status. Like, but the three judges say, you know, it's like, okay, just because he's not a star chef doesn't mean we're going to show any favoritism. And they're like, yeah, we're going to judge just what he puts on the plate. That's what we do. So I kind of get the feeling that the introduction of these judges indicates that, I don't know, I feel as though there is something involving the WGO that is on the horizon. Like, I can't imagine that they're going to, like, oh, they won the team competition against the Zombies group. End of series!
It'd be
and
weird.
And then the WGO judges would just have a bit part at the end.
It'd be weird to even, like, especially then also, like, denote different ranking levels for mm-hmm. them as well. Like, why first class and second class in there? So, I definitely do feel like that plays into it. Maybe they have some sort of thing too, cause, like he mentions, what the fuck's his restaurant?
Yukihira.
Yukihira wasn't in there. I imagine probably cause Joichiro just didn't give a fuck. Cause he rarely does. But I imagine that might play into something next. So, we shall see. There was also, what was the competition Joichiro was supposed to do and chickened out of the blue?
Blue, yeah.
So maybe that's what the future is for. And I don't get the impression anymore the series is ending. I think maybe it was just, let's just end. Or maybe not even let's end this part.
Maybe let's race a little bit but towards the conclusion of this arc.
Yeah, let's just get to the end of things for this.
Mm-hmm. So Soma and Kinokuni start to put the finishing touches on each of their dishes. Soma is pouring some sauce over his dish. Kinokuni's deep frying the tempura. They make a big deal out of how ridiculously beautiful her soba noodles look. And, she serves up chilled soba noodles with Sakura shrimp tempura on the side. And, we don't actually see what, well, Soma, they established he was making fried yakisoba, but we don't see his actually completed dish.
We don't. And, this isn't like an out there prediction where I'm just going to be like, Kinokuni loses because I mean, come the fuck on. Like the alternative is Soma gets kicked out of the school.
The first round and just has to fucking ride the bench while the good chefs kick ass.
But I feel it is worth noting that Kinokuni doesn't seem to look all that confident in this final panel. Maybe it's just the way she's drawn here, but it doesn't. Like Soma,
especially the way her mouth is drawn.
Yeah, like with Soma, you could easily see it's a look of pure confidence, but Kinokuni seems to have been shaken off the fact that Soma's been doing things differently throughout this whole kind of competition.
And also the dashiki was just flat like, you're gonna lose.
Yeah, so I feel like she's already almost thrown in the towel, but I'm curious to get at least what's coming next.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Dr. Stone. So, okay. Let me see if I get that. So, a bunch of stuff happened last time because we covered two chapters. It's revealed that Tsukasa is going to be our antagonist, at least for the time being. They freed Yuzuriha from her prison. And then Senku wrapped things up by saying, okay, you know, you've got two choices. Either we're going to stand here and confront him, or we're going to run the fuck away. So Taiju's immediately like, all right, yeah, let's stand and fight. And he says, like, hey, you don't misjudge Yuzuriha and me. You know, we're not cowards. And Senku's like, no, I'm basically saying it might be the most rational choice for you to get the hell away. And Yuzuriha is in the background like, I don't know what's going on, but I'll do whatever I can to help.
It's like, bobbing her head up. It's like, thanks for being a, you know, stick it
thanks
to
for
us.
Being here, Yuzuriha. But Taiju says, like, hey, you know, he's running around smashing people, so we have to stop them. And Tsukasa arrives to hear this. And he's still got the freaking lion pelts. He casts it off him. He's like, killing them? I'm just thinning the herd to prepare this new world. It's so ridiculous. He's got freaking shards of stone from people he's shattered still on him. He's brushing them off off of his body. You can see, like, a stone eye falling out of his hands and stuff. This guy's so ridiculous.
The calluses he has on his knuckles is ridiculous.
Yeah. He's been hard at work punching statues.
It's like, I spend my days punching statues of families I just don't like. It's like, does he have a better way to phrase that? No.
Senku, kind of moves towards the, chemicals that they've got on hand, kind of defending them, but Taiju steps between Senku and Yuzuriha and Tsukasa, and then rushes towards Tsukasa, saying, hey, you know, Senku, take care of Yuzuriha if anything happens to me. So he rushes towards him, and Senku is like, oh, freaking that idiot. This guy killed a lion with his bare hands. He pulls out a fucking crossbow, and he's like, ah, my last resort secret weapon, I must kill him! And Tsukasa immediately just snatches the crossbow bolt out of the air. Well, okay then.
I mean, he killed a lion with his fist. I don't think snatching a fucking crossbow out of the air is that crazy hard.
So he grabs the crossbow bolt and then whirls around and does this spinning heel kick towards Taiju. Taiju manages to block it with the back of his hand, and Tsukasa's like, you're the first to ever stay upright after taking on one of my kicks. Of course he is. But he also observes that, hey, you, it's not that you didn't have the chance to attack me, you just chose not to, so why didn't you? And Taiju says, I don't hit people, but you can punch and kick me all you like. In return, you've got to agree to stop smashing those statues, Tsukasa, because killing people like that is wrong. And he's like, freaking, like, opening up his shirt. He's like, yeah, just hit me as much as you want. And Tsukasa is like, okay. So you're saying I can keep hitting you instead of destroying the statues. That's what your offer is. And Taiju's like, yes! Tsukasa's like, I don't get it.
He's like, I don't understand. What's the quid pro quo to this? I don't. Instead of punching statues and threatening to hurt, I just punch you instead? I don't.
What logic is there to this deal that you're making? And even like Senku in the background is just like, this is so fucking stupid.
I love that this is his idea though. He's just like, I don't hurt people. That's not who I am. So I'll just, but I can take pain, so I'll be a punching bag for your aggression essentially. But Tsukasa's like, but that isn't what I actually want.
Oh, man. So Tsukasa as a Taiju goes over to Yuzuriha. And he's like, okay, so you're saying that you won't attack me. What if I were to kill Yuzuriha? And Taito immediately jumps back and puts himself between the two of them. And Yuzuriha realizes, oh, this is what Senku was talking about. I'm like a hostage in this situation. So running away being the most rational choice, he really was right. But all of a sudden, Taiju starts bleeding profusely from the head because he did get hit in the head, by, Tsukasa's hit. And, so, Tsukasa's like, there's no need to fight among friends. You go on protecting Yuzuriha, better her than statues you never knew. I'll do what I'm meant to do here, so don't get in my way. And so he picks up his lion pelt and throws it over his shoulders and heads off on his own. It's kind of hard to root against him because he's just too cool. He's so ridiculously over the top.
Well, it's nice too that he has it just like he's still playing along with this kind of like charade that this is going to be a very like, this is still like a sociable situation between them, that they're still like friends.
Or maybe he actually does feel that way. Maybe he still really does believe, hey, you know, you guys are the best part of society, so I've got no reason to kill you except for the fact that you could try and stop me. And, I've just proven that you can't.
Well, yeah, I do think that plays into it. Cause clearly if he did just want to kill them, he would. He's shown that he really doesn't have much of an inkling that could stop him should he desire something needs to be removed from this world. But it's not that like he was betrayed. Cause he did get shot with a crossbow. I mean, he stopped it. It was like nothing to him, but still like Senku pulling at a crossbow feels like a very aggressive, hey, we're not cool anymore kind of act. And he's just like, you do what you do. Like, it's kind of a threat in a way, because he's like, you keep protecting her, and just let me handle my statues. Almost saying, if you try to do the other, maybe I'll start getting mixed in with the other side of things as well. But just that notion of like, no, we can still keep living in a, you know, peaceful society.
Well, he is kind of crazy, so.
It's interesting, definitely.
So, Senku is racked. He picks up the crossbow bolt, and he's like, man, he stopped this arrow that was going like 200 kilometers an hour. The only way to stop Tsukasa is to turn the clock forward. In all of history, humanity's greatest invention. And Taiju on the ground is like, smartphones? No! Not smartphones! Still not smartphones!
I like that Yuzuriha also, like, she has the face that fucking Tsukasa had last time, where she's just baffled by his stupidity.
And Senku's like, no, firearms, we've got to make gunpowder. Stone tools came about 2 million years ago, while gunpowder was invented much more recently, in 700 AD, which means we've got to take one giant warp forward of 1,998,700 years. I can't wait.
He's basically just playing Civilization on, like, super fast forward mode. He's like, you invented arrows. Now you've invented nuclear fission. Like, sweet.
And, so they're like, okay, we've gotta go and make gunpowder in order to save the world. So, still really enjoying the hell out of this series. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is maybe the chapter of Dr. Stone I enjoyed the least, if only, and not because it was a bad chapter or anything like that, it was what felt like a very short chapter to me.
It really did.
I felt like I went through this chapter in like 6 pages, and, you know, reading through it, I could see it's a lot longer, obviously, but this was one where I was like, man, that's it for this week? Oh, damn, this is a bummer, but it is still cool. It's tough to completely buy into this conclusion, because the insinuation of it is, our success is going to be shooting a high school student, which I feel like just can't happen in Jump. Like, it's just not going to happen that, like, their turnabout moment comes in, like the fucking Ace Attorney music comes in. Is it just like, eat lead, Tsukasa!
Let's murder that bastard in cold blood.
But I do sit here and I'm saying, like, what's going to happen, I guess, because that's not a real possibility in my mind. I'm looking forward to it, though. And it's still fun. Yeah. Alright, so we are going to jump ahead then to a different series here. And I apologize because I am trying to navigate the Kindle app here. So two new series got picked up in Jump this week. We mentioned at the end of last week's episode that two new series are going to be coming out, or rather, one new series is going to come out, and they surprised us by putting
Turns out
two.
That was a lie!
They did. They lied to us, those dirty, dirty liars at Jump. No, instead we got two series. The first being the aforementioned Robot Laserbeam, which we mentioned at the top of the show we're not going to be adding to the recap itself, at least for the time being. But the second series is one we are going to discuss for the time being, that being We Never Learn, the romantic comedy series about, I'm trying to remember his name. Yuiga? That sounds weird. I'm gonna call him Yugi. Yugi, who is a tutor student.
Not Osamu.
And, yeah, I'm gonna call him Not Osamu. So Not Osamu, who is a tutor, and
Narayuki. Is that easier than Yuiga?
Not Osamu. And the two high school girls that he is tutoring, the two classmates of his that he's tutoring, the supercomputer Thumbelina, who wants to be an English major, essentially.
And what is her name, Chris?
Ogata.
Good.
And okay. The art, or the, what do you call it? Humanities expert who wants to be a mathematician, essentially, Furuhashi. Essentially, he's got his angry, like, temperamental tsundere and his airheaded clumsy girl. Two love interests.
She's not tsundere, she's kudere.
Kudere, sorry.
She's, yeah.
So that's our harem, Nick. That's
it's not
that's
a harem yet, Chris. It's not a harem unless there are three girls. Right now it's a love triangle. It's not a harem yet. And I'm sure that considering that so much of the series seems to be based upon the choice between the two girls, that if a third girl were to be introduced into the equation, then it will be some time before she is introduced into this.
So the first page of this, because we get chapters 4 and 5 this week. The question, chapter 4 is, a fish is to water as a genius is to X. This is
That's
the opening.
Pretty cool. That is actually, that's a cool title. Yes. That is the picture.
Is the opening shot of this week's chapter.
New girl.
Who is a swimmer. She is a swimmer, so she's often in a swimsuit. And the first shot is her, like, kind of picking a wedgie out of her fucking swimsuit as she looks over at the camera.
So this crossover with Keijo came a lot earlier than I thought it was going to.
So we are introduced in this chapter to Not Osamu's longtime friend, Ruka Takamoto.
Yes.
So she is, as mentioned, a swimmer. She is a member of the swim team, and she often comes to Not Osamu to read his notes and basically copy them. He notes every time, please don't just copy them word for word. And she's like, I copy them one word for word. Thanks, Chief. She literally says, no problem. I'll just copy everything exactly and give it right back.
Thanks.
And everyone's just like, God damn you, fucking Not Osamu. You have another super hot chick who's very excited to hang out with you. And it's like, yeah, he's a harem protagonist at this point. He's going to have a lot of hot high school girls all over him.
I was honestly kind of disappointed in this chapter. It's like, wow. That took you no time.
No time at all. Which, you know what, is somewhat understandable. Again, Jump can be a very cutthroat magazine, so if you aren't popular very quickly, you're not gonna have a chance. So this, you know, maybe is a way to be like, hey, some people like this kind of girl, let's put this waifu option in there, get people into this series. Yeah. But look, Nick, Persona 5 is a big thing right now. All I fucking hear are waifu options. I don't even know who the characters in it are. I just know waifus are a big thing, so.
Admittedly, We Never Learn hasn't been doing especially well in the rankings. It's
not right.
It's doing okay. From what I get the impression that from this big string of jump starts that we've gotten, that U19 is doing the worst, because of course it is. Hungry Marie, unfortunately, doesn't look like it's doing particularly well. This one is doing pretty okay. And Dr. Stone is doing a little bit better than that. That's the impression I get. So we'll see how it goes. I get because so many series were introduced in a row, I highly doubt that all of them are going to be canceled right away. And so out of the five of them, I would bet that this has probably got the second or third best chance of continuing. So.
Yeah. So, Not Osamu is called into the principal's office to give a progress report on the two students he is mentoring. And the principal says, "Oh, hey, by the way, I hear you're friends with Takamoto. Is that right?" And he's like, yeah, he's like, just answer the question.
Where are you going with this?
And we get another very cheesecakey shot, because if you haven't seen this character, if you're not reading along, she is a very tanned girl, presumably very because tanned. She swims a lot. And because she's, I guess, always swimming, that's where she gets the tan. She has very pronounced tanned lines. So there's a shot of her as a mermaid, of course, tastefully with seashells over her fucking underage nipples and with very obvious tan lines. And it's accompanied with the principal kind of pumping her up, being her hype man, who's like, yeah, a sports hero endowed with superhuman coordination, technique, motivation, and stamina as the shining star of our swim club and champion of every freestyle match she enters. She's a school treasure, nicknamed the Shimmering Ebony Mermaid Princess. However, she's an idiot. It's weird he's going on. And, like, I guess it's fine because it's like a teacher being proud of a student, but it's like, this is a lot. It's when accompanied with that image makes it sound a little creepier. But yeah, she says like her academic skills are not up to stuff. And there's just a like shot of her, like not actually there, but her being like, I'm an idiot. He says, so much of an idiot, I guess even applying for an academic scholarship, or an athletic scholarship won't help her. Which I'm like, is that even possible?
Have you seen some of the people who have gone into the NFL? Like, seriously.
There are some dumb motherfuckers who get scholarships solely based because they're good at sports.
You ever hear about Mike Allstott? He was not a smart man.
And yet you die trying to get an autograph from him. It was so weird.
Apparently.
So, you can guess where this is going. The principal asks Not Osamu to become her tutor, and his response is, "Over my dead body, sir." And then we cut away, and he's like, "That's just what I was thinking, but I couldn't say it." I'm like,
I mean, the comic timing on the back and forth is really good, because he's like, "I'd like to ask you to serve as a tutor for one more student. Over my dead body."
Yeah, they both have like the sparkles behind them, you know. It's a great back and forth there. But like every moment I spend with this character, I'm like, he's more and more like Osamu. Where he's just like, I couldn't work up the nerve to say what was on my mind. So he goes to visit Takamoto to essentially tell her what he's doing. And I guess this is something they're kind of introducing, that she does like sexy poses for him, I guess just to tease him.
To tease him.
Man. And he just doesn't give a fuck. And then there's another shot of her picking a fucking wedgie out because...
Well, first of all, hang on. Because there's the bit where, because she stopped swimming because she's done her lap and, you know, she's taken her swim cap off and she's like, "Hey, Naruyuki, did you come to spy on me? You think I'm hot in this? You want this?" And he's just like, "No, can you knock out the sex poses?" And all she's doing is she's doing this.
Yeah.
It's like, is that a sexy pose?
Well, I guess if she's winking and the presumably that little like music note where she's like, "You like swimwear?" I mean, that would definitely, you'd have to interpret that as some kind of flirting.
So do you think that she is adjusting her wedgie to emphasize her butt or to actually adjust it out? Because that is a gratuitous fucking shot.
It is a very gratuitous. She has got, like, I don't know if there's tiers of wedgie, but this would definitely be like top tier wedgie. Like, this is, like, if you're on the Mortal Kombat, like, fucking tower of opponents, this is the one where you have to fight, like, Sub-Zero and Scorpion back to back.
Fucking dork. So, Yuga says that he's gonna tutor this girl. And she's like, "No!" And he's like, "Well, see, there's a policy where you've got to be able to pass an English exam, even in order to get into athletics college." And she's like, "Okay, I better forget college then." It's like, because she's got to do some academic work. She's meaning it's like, "Oh, well, it was just a dream, I guess." It wasn't meant to be.
She's like, "I gave up." Bye. So he's chasing her around and falls in the pool. She saves
him. Well, hang on. There's a brief moment here because he's like, you're going to pass that test. I'm going to make you study. And she's like, no, I don't want to study. He's chasing her around the edge of the pool. And at first she's just like, no, no, no. And then she's eventually like, hey, this is really fun. She sees no way he can catch you.
Yeah, she's just running away from him. She's like, I hate studying. And then, yeah, he fucking falls in the pool. She gets him out. And that's, of course, when the other girls show up, see him saying, like, cause it's, you know, it's that classic misinterpretation of it where
it's pretty ridiculous though.
He's still trying to get her to accept his tutoring and she's fighting him. So he's like, he's on top of her as she's soaking wet, like, you can't get away from me now. And she's like, no, let me go. And I don't know why he says that resistance is futile, prepared to be educated like never before, my dear. And I'm like, why would he put emphasis on educated? Like, unless he was mean and it's a double entendre.
Look, there's only so much I can take.
So yeah, they do the whole joke of the two girls, like, beating him up because they think he's a disgusting pervert until they realize, oh, hey, no, it's not that actually at all. And she starts to realize, Takamoto does, that Yuga starts to have, like, the other girls seem to have feelings for him. Or maybe she's just picking up on the idea that they're spending a lot of time with him and he's important in their lives. Mm-hmm. So she immediately's like, all right, well, I'll be your student as well. And we're a team now. We'll all be a member of your group, essentially. And he's just like, why the change of heart? And she's like, ah, why not? Stop asking questions, bro.
I don't have a thing for you.
We cut away then. It's the end of the day. Takamoto is walking back home and she has a flashback to when she was younger and she was asking, Nadosamu for his notes again. And he's like, all right, fine. Don't copy it word for word. She's like, thanks. She then encounters him talking to one of the classmates who's like, why do you always give her your notes? And he's like, well, I'm not just lending them to anybody. I'm lending them to her because Takamoto sacrifices everything for the swim team. She doesn't have friends. She doesn't have time for homework or anything else. She gives everything into what she's doing on the swim team. So she needs this extra help. And that's what gave her kind of her crush. Hey, it's a cat. It's what gave her a crush on her as well. And there's also the joke of like, yeah, but those tan lines are mega sexy, huh? He's like, what? No way. She didn't hear that part, though. Or she just didn't care.
Didn't care. On the one hand, I kind of like this idea that, you know, she grew to like Yuga because he saw her differently than everyone else saw her. Uh-huh. You know, a lot of people would find her behavior annoying. But he puts up with it because he sees that she's got a good heart, and so she really appreciates that. On the other, though, this chapter really kind of made her seem like a selfish bitch.
She definitely does not endear herself particularly well. She is very childish in mm-hmm. a way that's unflattering. Like, I get it. Her thing isn't that she's a scholar. She's an athlete. She considers herself a dumb jock, so she's going to be a lot more flighty and a lot more kind of self-obsessed almost in a way, just because, you know, her thing is athletic. So there is that to her, but she is a very big personality that I feel is going to be a very big hit or miss for this series, because we're going to talk about the next chapter as well, chapter 5, the pathos of a celebrated genius equals X. And she's a big part of this chapter too. It's not a chapter focused on her. It's actually one a lot more about, what's her name?
Fumino.
About Fumino. But she's still involved in it. She's essentially a main character now, it feels like, just as much as the other two girls. And she brings along a very different energy than those two did.
She really has this kind of driving force that, you know, sort of mixes things up and kind of forces things to happen.
It's a different kind of energy than what we're used to, and it still a little bit remains to be seen whether or not this is a good or bad thing for the series for me. There's parts of her I do like, because this chapter essentially opens up with them all studying, and she's just like, oh my god, I can't, I've been sitting here for so long, I need to move, and like, it's been 30 minutes. So she just snatches fucking Rizu's boob.
It's a really weird moment. She's like, your tits are big despite the fact that you're small.
There's no setup for it. She's just like, I want to move. And Rizu's like, please be quiet, I'm trying to study. Panel of her like sitting there. And then just like, bam! Yeah! She just grabs her tit. And I'm like, why?
What cup size? You've got a really big cup size on, Batman!
It's like, I don't understand why this, like, it's not like there was a moment like we saw her eyeline go to the chest or anything. Just a moment where I feel like she heard a blank space happened and she was just like, I do this now! So, yeah, that's what I mean. I don't know if this is like, it's going to be funny or she's just going to be annoying. That's what's going to kind of remain to be seen. But yeah. This chapter ultimately isn't about her. It's a lot more about Fumino. And it particularly involves the fact that she has another student who has been asking her out several times. An older student, I believe, or maybe it's a fellow classmate of theirs. I thought they said this somewhere distinctly, but his name is Yamaoka. His name is Yamaoka. And he has been, asking.
This got more and more confident as he got more and more wrong.
Yamaoka, he's been asking Fumino out several times and she has always turned him down, but in a very gentle way that kind of suggests, like she doesn't outright ever just say, I'm not interested. She always kind of puts it in a way of saying, I can't right now, I'm really flattered, but maybe some other time, essentially. So that's how the conversation keeps going. Takamoto has this moment where she says, yeah, playing hard to get in love is important, but sometimes turning on the va-va-boom can add spark and color to your life.
I actually more like the follow-up panel because, Ogata is like, oh really, Takamoto? You speak from copious experience, I take it. And she's like, oh, you know, I've done thorough research. And she's like, so no. Okay.
Just fucking schools are right there. Narusamu picks her up and is like, hey, I apologize for spying on you on that moment. Let's go do some more studying. Takamoto and Rizu have to leave for their various things, so it's just the two of them. And this is kind of interesting because he mentions, like, hey, if something's bothering you, I'm here to listen. I'm your tutor after all, so I'm here for anything you need. And she notes that she's actually, quote, I'm afraid of guys who are pushy. My father is that kind of guy. And there's no more of like a real follow-up to that. But that seems like a very important line that makes me wonder if this series might actually put some deeper kind of backstories to these characters. Because at any time, generally, someone like a teenager is noting some of their issues in life, have to deal with their parents, that tends to be something that's involved.
Yeah. It's a good way to end up in Riverdale, let me tell you that.
Yeah, so I'm actually kind of excited at the notion that maybe there's, like, going to be some deeper kind of stories to these characters and the way they are. But essentially, she just notes that whenever someone is assertive with her, she gets very timid and meek in response. She doesn't have a good way of kind of handling it.
Right.
She can't turn those people down. She just loses the nerve to do so. So, Narusamu basically kind of is walking by, happens to see Yamaoka, and stops him. It's just what his name is. And basically says, hey, she
goes like, I have a hard time saying no, Gawagan.
Gawagan. Basically tells him like, hey, she is trying to study for this exam. Fumio is trying to study for the exam. So please, until then, don't hit on her anymore. Ask her out. And I was expecting.
What? Yeah, boyfriend or something? Yeah. Hey.
Hi, what are we doing over here? Well, over there, we over here. I was expecting this to be the moment where the guy was just like,
I don't even care about her. She's just a body to me anyway. But he doesn't actually go to that level. Like, he doesn't come off like a super weirdo. Like, he's weirded out by this. Like, what are you? It's like, are you her boyfriend? Why is this your business, essentially?
He's still a douchebag, but he's not as much of a douchebag as you normally see in situations like this in fiction.
Yeah, I'm used to, like, the very over-the-top cartoonish level of bad guy who revealed themselves here.
I just want to use her for sex and then throw her in the garbage with all the other women.
Yeah, he'd just be like, whatever, she's just another notch in my belt. Hoorumph. So it ends up with Not Osamu getting pushed and, like, hitting his face against a pole. He starts bleeding.
It's such a cartoon slow-mo. As he pushes him, it's like, big action panel! And then he would get hit to his head, conk, and the guy's like, oops.
Yeah. Oops. And then he turns, and for some reason he's like bleeding down the face. His glasses aren't hurt at all. His glasses are fine. And I guess the blood is kind of scary. And then added on to it, Not Osamu like grabs their legs like, please do it. Please do what I'm asking. I'm such a baby. I don't know what else to do.
Say you'll leave her alone. I won't let go unless you say you'll leave her alone. I'm fine.
Yeah, he's basically like, she is not worth this. I don't, whatever. It was a crush or something. Have her, whatever. He just leaves. Yuiga's like, well, all's well that ends well. As there's blood going down, as he's like wiping the fucking bitch off his face, essentially. My work here is done.
I mean, it's like, you need medical attention, you big dummy dumb.
She takes him to the nurse's office. He just notes like, oh, I've never seen you angry before, but hey, they have a little moment where they get a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And we also find out.
And then a little joke. I definitely liked this chapter more than I liked the fourth chapter, but it really feels like there's been a cumulative effect the more we've gotten of this series, to the point where it's like, yeah, I could definitely get into this series if it sticks around. I still think that there are some problems with it. I really think that, the amount of fan service can get quite awkward, and I'm not especially happy to see that Iruka is part of the series at this point. So we'll see how she turns out.
Yeah, I think that the easiest way I can kind of note it is just it's not as bad as like a two love rule, but it's definitely reminding me why I felt Nisekoi was the better series overall, because it definitely was more kind of humorous with the characters and didn't have to quickly go to fan service like this so much. I feel like any time we see Takamoto, there's just gonna be a scene of her fucking snapping her wedgie out.
Even when she's like wearing pants.
She's just like, hold on, let me pick this wedgie out. It just sounds like a whip going up.
For some reason.
Like, that's weird.
Okay. All right. We've got a lot of discuss in Promised Neverland. So let's just dive right into it. It is chapter 35, Action 4, with a fucking badass color, cover page of Isabella and Emma fucking getting in each other's faces while the house is burning behind them. It looks so cool. So last time Isabella was going to go off and try and retrieve all the children, but she was interrupted when Phil suddenly showed up. And we cut back to the escaping group to see that Ray is observing that not only is Phil missing, all of the 4-year-olds and under are not there with them. And so Emma says, yeah, I actually thought about what you had said, and so we're not taking them with us. We're going to leave the 4-year-olds here. But she clarifies quickly, we're not abandoning them, we're just not taking them now. So we get a flashback to a month before, with Don and Gilda essentially checking in with Emma to give her a progress report. And, they've said, yeah, we've gotten down to the 5-year-olds and all of them at this point are with us and they're ready to go with us and our training is going well. So they're like, okay, so what should we do with the rest of the kids? And it's actually Gilda who brings up, can we actually take all the youngest kids with us? Is this really feasible? She says, it's not like I don't believe in Norman's plan, but there is a cliff, it's winter, Norman's not around, there are already so many factors that are different from our initial plan, and even after we get out, there will be a lot of unpredictable elements. I know it's a little late in the game to say this, but can we really take them along? So Emma says, I can't leave them. And Ray's right, though, Gilda, you're right, but I just don't want to have anyone else shipped out. And I want to take all of the family. Everyone will escape together. And Gilda says, everyone. But what about the kids and the other plans? And they're like, and Don's like, oh, yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
I feel like it's a moment that all of them were just like, right.
Yeah.
I guess that's a point too.
Yeah. Gilda says, like, I know they're not part of our family, you know? And because we've never seen them before, but, you know, they're just out. They're right next to us in the same situation as us, just beyond the wall. They're just like us, a family that lives there not knowing anything. And she kind of regrets bringing this up because it really does throw a big monkey wrench into things, but Emma's like, no, you're right. So they get Phil. And he's like, I'm Phil! Hi!
Hey, everybody!
He's got one of the books by, what was his name again?
William Minerva.
Minerva. With him. And, we get a little bit of a time passage, and she's like, hey, I've got to talk to you about something, and tells him the whole explanation. And, Phil's like, I knew it. It's just like I thought.
All according to plan.
Yes. When I first saw this, I was like, what the fuck?
He's like, that's expected.
I knew once I... By judging the position of the stars and the planets.
He's like, well, that does fit with my hypothesis.
His voice is changing more and more. He's just going to be philosopher Sean Connery from now on. Ah, oh, yes.
Ah, just like I thought. Well, we're going to have to find a new way around this, but I got a strategy. I can give Mom a good slap. Women deserve those from time to time. Like when they burn the roast, or you just kind of feel like you need to let it out.
Just as I was discussing in my post-coitus discussion with pushing along.
Ah, Tushy, the times we had together.
Well, she used to be a deviant lesbian before I gave her a good what for.
And by what for, I mean I smacked her, because again, you could do that.
Just got to pin her down, yes.
Anyway, where's my humanitarian award? Why don't you invite me to the Oscars anymore?
Second character from Promised Neverland. Okay. Phil explains, like, yeah, I had actually thought about what Sister Crone said meant when she said harvest, and she was looking through Ray's drawers, and Emma, you were all scared. So this indicates that he came to this conclusion quite recently, but it really does play up that because Ray was about the same age when he figured all this shit out. He doesn't give a big speech about baby members or anything, but apparently he's a very sharp young kid, because he picked all this up and seemingly had just about figured this all out around the same age that Ray did.
I don't need baby memories. I got street smarts. I'm wise to the streets. It's what I can do.
Ever since I tutored that young African-American lad in the ways of typing.
Ever since I cut off the last head of my opponent and gained the power of the one. It's like, you didn't do that!
Every Sean Connery character.
I don't even think you were the one who did that.
Ever since I came across pretty boy Tom Sawyer and taught him to effectively shoot a hunting rifle. I was buried in rocks at the end, but I was totally alive because a gypsy told me that Africa would not allow me to die. Only the worst Sean Connery.
I remember it. I was in a submarine in the water.
I should let them sing. Oh, I fucking love Sean Connery, Phil.
I remember as I was... the voice
Phil,
was animated.
We need to explain our plan to you.
I was an animated...
I already have a plan, woman.
I was an animated bird called Sir Billy from 20 Trials. My last role, if you will.
Oh, my God.
I played Sir August de Winter from the Avengers. Not the Avengers you're thinking of. A much more British one with a lot less cool characters.
All right. Okay. Okay. Okay,
okay. I remember when I was a time bandit.
God damn it. All right. So, Emma says, all right, I've got two choices that I'm trying to decide between. Because I could take everyone, including the babies, but I might also have to leave the kids under 4 years old behind. And she doesn't say that she's leaving the... she says... oh, God, I'm sorry. I'm getting kind of lightheaded because I'm laughing too much. But she explains the reason why she's really deciding between these choices, because she says nobody actually gets shipped out until they're at least 6 years old. So even Manya, who has the earliest birthday, will have at least a year and a half. And 15 of the other kids are gonna be going, absolutely. These 50 kids are definitely leaving. But in order to raise high-quality kids again, they can't kill the younger ones who have the potential to be high-quality. And in that respect, the current six, who are four-year-olds, have good scores. So at worst, I estimate that we have 2 years. So she hasn't actually explained this decision to Donna Gilda, but Phil figures it out right away. He's like, yes, I can wait. You may leave us behind. Yes. And I shall run the orphanage, you know.
He's like, understand that I will be the man who would be king. Like, wait, are you just a Sean Connery who names the different movies you've been in? Well, some say the diamonds are forever. But never say never again.
And you only live twice. Moonraker.
Shalako. Did you guys read the paper? I heard there was a murder on the Orient Express. Everyone's like, I fucking hate you, Phil. I can't wait to leave.
Ah, talking back, I see. I have to give you a good smack on the ass. I come from a different time.
Send you all the way to Cuba.
Actually, I'm quite confused. Why are Gilda and Emma even here? I should only be discussing this with Don. Man talk.
Don't you two have a roast to cook?
You should be barefoot and pregnant. It was a different time I come from. All right. So, Emma says, all right, yeah, I've left everything in Phil's hands, essentially. Phil is, we're entrusting him to deal with this. Only he knows the truth. The other kids are going to live in ignorance for the time being. I'll leave the kids four and under here, but I'll return for sure within 2 years. And then I'll escape with Phil and the others and all of the kids of the other four plants. To do that, I'm leaving them behind him. So this is a really big moment for this series. Obviously, you know, the chapter's only about halfway done. We've got more to discuss. But, I mean, I brought up a few weeks ago when we were discussing, it seemed like Ray was dead, you know, that it looked like this was when we were going to head into the next part of the series. And now it seems as though we have a very definitive, this is where we're headed. It's not just going to be about the kids escaping. It's got to be about them launching an escape plan for everyone else. That is going to be the next big step going forward that we're going to be working on. Which, I mean, that seems right to me. So
yeah, this seems like the most mature kind of decision that could have been made, because, you know, there's that notion of like, oh, hey, I like that all or nothing kind of mentality of no, all of us are getting away or none of us are. And Emma finally has come to the realization that although it is the most optimistic decision to say we'll take everyone, it just isn't logically feasible. But the plus side of it is they know the way the system works, and they know that the children here shouldn't actually be in any danger because of what their purpose is, that they're raised to be food that's of high quality that comes with age. So it's nice that this decision was made, and this doesn't feel like it's out of nowhere for Phil to be the one who's kind of taken this on, because I noted he's like up in that same tier, being one of the smartest kids. He's been shown several times, and his reaction is really kind of nice too. I like the notion that even Phil was kind of like, "Yeah, this is all starting to make sense of what I was thinking."
Yeah.
So it's like, "Oh, that's really cool." So I'm really excited for that, and I'm really eager to kind of see what happens here.
So we cut back over to Phil with Isabella, and mom says, "Where are the other children?" And there's this quick little glance down at his face, which you can't see as he gets, you know, his determined look in his eyes with his weird fucking mouth. He leads her off, somewhere else. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of children who are still, you know, out in the woods, just outside of the building. And, Isabella's thinking, "Oh, all right. So about 15 kids are gone. The only ones who escaped are five and up." She realizes what's going on. All right. I've lost a lot of time. It took me a while to get this radio out because some asshole jammed a keyhole in my office. The kids are, of course, really freaking out because only Phil knows what's going on. They're just panicking. Emma and the others are missing, and they're afraid, and they're crying. And Isabella says, "Okay, I'll be right back. Make sure to stay here," because she's still got business to do. She heads off with the radio, and she's like, "Okay, I've got to catch up. I've got time." They can't go down the cliff. Good. What the fuck was that?
I know it's confusing for you. I muted myself on that. I'll tell you afterwards.
Anyway. So Isabella basically figures out what the kids are up to for their escape plan. She says, "All right, they must be heading for the bridge because they'll have concluded that they can't go down the cliff. It's the only way to get outside. So I'll get ahead of them. I'll capture them." And we also get a little bit of a flashback to when she was a kid on the plant stood at the top of the wall and looked down the cliff, which is a cool moment. I like that we get these little flashes of how Isabella came to the point where she is now.
Like knowing that all the moms have essentially been Emmas that just didn't succeed, that didn't reach this point, presumably, that fell somewhere along the way. I hope there's like a moment when mom was trying to like run away and Phil was just like, "Mom, I don't advise this course of action. It feels like a bridge too far. We don't want to be the Untouchables."
What does that even mean? "I'm four!"
He's like, "What I'm saying is Highlander 2, The Quickening." It's like, what?
The Quickening.
"Aren't we all a little bit Dragonheart?" Like, wait, you're not even feeding this in anymore. You're just stating movies you're in. Finding Forster. From Russia with Love. Parentheses, the video game.
Phil, will you put down that IMDb page? He's
like, "No, you can't take this from me."
Alright.
Alright.
So Isabella uses the radio to call headquarters, essentially, and says, "Alright, so there are some kids that have escaped. Sound the alarm." The kids hear the alarm going off as they're running down the wall. And we cut to inside the demon's realm, and one of them says to as an alert goes out to their employees, and one of them says, "Go ahead and kill those who aren't the finest quality. Once you see them, capture them immediately." So shit's gonna get real.
That it will. Let's see how they react to this. This is one of the parts of the plan. I don't know if they could have much expectation of what's going to happen. They don't have any idea. Think of what happens when security activates.
Yeah. I mean, are the demons themselves going to be confronting the kids? What's going on?
I mean, it looks like you see, like, demons behind him that seem to be holding, like, weapons of some sort. So,
And they also note that the kids have a long ways to go because they're on the opposite side of the exit from where they start off. So.
All right, Let's jump over then to Seven Deadly Sins, chapter 214. It won't reach you by then. So we are actually somewhat finishing up with this flashback.
We're almost done.
We're close.
Yeah.
So last time, King was inside the body he transported back into. He had encountered Lo, who was holding Garrard's body, and he lost his shit and was preparing to throw his spear to kill him. But as he's doing so, he sees that Lo is smiling, and not like in a sinister way, and it reminds him of the time he had impaled Bon with his spear in the same way, and he realized it's basically that exact same situation as somebody essentially accepting their fate, and he knows kind of how that already went. So instead, he stops the spear right before it would impale Lo's face, and he says, "I won't kill you." Then the next shot is Lo's body, like, separated in half, and King's like, what?
Blown away so completely that his arm, which is, like, from the forearm down is all that's left, is still hanging in the air. So, yeah.
Yeah, just fucking gone. And he's just like, what? And then he turns over and he sees the real body of the person he's in, kind of behind him, and that's when he wakes up, essentially, out of the dream.
It's a really creepy fucking image of her because he's like so emotional and angry that her face has gotten demonic looking, wide eyes and
yeah. So Giosina basically explains that, you know, you've lived through my life and you know the situation that I was in. I didn't realize that Garrard was alive at the time. I didn't even check. I'm a sorry excuse for a brother.
He's a guy too. Fucking fairies.
Fey assholes. He's just like, this, yeah, what happened? I got obsessed with my anger and it's what happened. So why didn't you kill Lo? And King explains, he says, there's no such thing as true evil. Every opponent that I've fought so far has had his or her own circumstances. Even the man that I consider worthless trash means the world to my sister. The same was true of you too. And I think Lo meant a lot to Garrard. So when I considered that, I couldn't kill him. It's a kind of nice idea that shows that King does have a good grasp of the shades of gray that really kind of occupy most humans.
And it shows that he's come a long way, too.
Yeah, that he doesn't see people as just villains anymore. He's seen that all these people have different sides to them. And even that, even someone who he considers just the worst, like Bond, he also just considered the people that are important to them, too. It's a nice little thing, but Giosina basically explains, he's like, yeah, well, that naivety isn't going to be very good for the fight ahead, because true evil does exist out there. And that's why I'm going to devote my heart and soul... Oh, sorry, King says that's why I'm going to devote my heart and soul to see myself through this fight, so I can protect the one who means the most to me. Then he's like, so what would have happened if I, like, had done what you did? And I was like, oh, well, I mean, it was an illusion, but if you did do it, you'd be so overcome with grief that you probably would just gone insane and been swallowed up by anger that you'd have been down the exact same path I was. And he's like, oh, God. He's like, but you didn't, so you're here. Good job.
You're cool, though.
But she's not back yet. And they kind of look over, and they see Diane still back in the body of the giant. She's still talking to the real, Gowther, sorry. And something starts breaking. I'm not sure what this is. It's a pillar of some kind. And I guess this is where the one Ten Commandment was. I forget when he got sealed in that.
Mm.
But it breaks open and the executioner pops out. Zeldris, who's, one of Melodius's brothers, I believe. His second brother?
Yeah. So. It's, yeah. Anyway. So, yeah. Good luck with that, Diane.
Does Diane as a giant have four arms?
The guy that whose body she's been occupying has always had four arms.
Huh. I don't know. I just didn't feel like I noticed that until now.
It's a little bit of a difficult detail to miss, dude.
I don't know why. I just, like, never paid attention to it until just now. And I was like, is there a second giant? So I like this chapter. I do like the growth that King showed and the way that kind of story all played to an end there. Hopefully, since King's out of this flashback, Diane will be able to get out relatively soon. We'll be able to get back into the story proper.
Yep. All right. I'm pretty much agreed with you on that. It's been the most gripping flashback from beginning to end, but, I mean, if it gets us a little bit more character development for our main characters, then I'm cool with it, and, it looks like we're getting that, so.
Yeah.
All right. Let's, go over to Black Clover, page 106. We got this far.
We got this.
So, Asta and Yuno are, you know, being celebrated for their accomplishments and, the accomplishments of their guilds and stuff. And of course they have a little bit of banter back and forth, which I'm happy for because, you know, shows a surprising amount of, like, personality in this exchange. Cause he says like, hey, look, it looks like you got quite a few stars, Asta, but I'm going to be Wizard King instead of you. Asta's like, well, no, I'm gonna be Wizard King, and maybe I lost this time, but I'm getting twice as many stars as you next time. Well, then I'll win double that. Well, then I'll get five times that many. Okay, so how many more times stars than me are you getting at this point? 10 times? No, it's actually 20 times. You're wrong.
He just starts crying.
It's like, I overcome any challenge except math.
So the Wizard King gives a speech. Saying, hey, you know, this is Asta, the Black Bolt's most active rookie. You and Asta are the top two among rookies in star acquisition.
I like Ginger Stratt's comment. It's so much personality that I think it hinges on out of character. It's like, whoa, hold on. You know, it's not supposed to have this much character.
He just got a new version update. He's much more genuine seeming, you know. What's his face? That one asshole, crappy mage guy who's popped up occasionally? Zange, but a tremendous asshole. It's
Sekis or
Sek?
It's like Sek. I think it's maybe it is CK or maybe it is just SEKKE.
Yeah. And so he's like, I have a presents from the Boondocks! And I asked to get a genie skunk with no magic. Like, oh, they're peasants too. And Rebecca, who doesn't have a sign that says Rebecca here for work honor this time.
Maybe it's not her then. Maybe this is a
it might not. It might be someone else. You never know.
This is probably someone who will be important, unlike Rebecca, who's never going to be important.
So, Yuno says to his Sylph, who I guess is named Bell. I don't know if it's ever been established before. And he's at full power, and he summons this huge wind magic, turns into like this kind of crossbow. He's like, "Hey, Asta, catch!" And fires the blast at him. Asta draws his cleaver and knocks it away. The backlash blasts over all the people who are gathered there. And, Asta's like, why do you always do stuff like that, you big jerk? And Yuna's like, I'm glad you survived. If you died from a thing like that, you would have deserved it.
I do like that attack because, if I have not established yet firmly, bows and arrows are awesome, and a bow made out of tornadoes is super awesome.
It's pretty great. So everyone's like, yeah, they're peasants, but look at how awesome they are. Yeah, a round of applause for our two new magic knights, and let us overcome differences, rank, brand together, lead this country to victory. And everyone's like, the Wizard King said that we should be happy. Let's be happy. We are sheep. Yay! He told us to be happy for these people, and we're happy for them now. Yay!
It'd be great if he's like, and I didn't even need to use my brain control powers. But I got those from Hero Man over there. The most noble of all characters.
I'm Hero Man, you can trust me. There's a cool little moment because Asta and, you know, just soak in the attention that they're getting. It's a nice visual more than anything else, I think. Yeah, because they're just looking out from the stage over all the people gathered and being like, we were told to be happy, yay!
It's tough to, like, form an entirely original thought on this because my mind's just gonna be so influenced by the fact that I read Naruto kinda at that young, informative age. So even though
this, you know, isn't a unique trope to only those two series, the series does feel a lot like that. And it is one of those things where I'm like, man, this definitely didn't happen that quickly in Naruto at this point. At 100 chapters in, Naruto was still pretty well despised and things like that.
What was it that got him a bunch of praise? I think it was when he, like, saved the village from pain. Crowd of people turned for him.
That was when he finally got acknowledged as being beloved by the entire town. But I think he kind of earned it by the time he was, like, doing the saw, like, the... But I think by Shippuden, he had essentially been, like, won over most of the town. People didn't treat him with fear anymore, really.
Right.
But,
I've got two issues with this. One is that, which I kind of am trying to get past. But the other is the fact that you don't really have a lot of time to really soak it in before it's like, okay, anyway.
Yeah, like, it's just one of those things, like, I feel like it maybe should be a bigger moment, but maybe just because this isn't actually the moment we're meant, that's really meant to establish that they've made it, so to speak.
Alright. So, after that we get the remainder of the rankings for the, 9 guilds, and, Annalise is gonna be so proud of me. I took out an Excel sheet, and I compared the results from the previous year to this year.
Wow.
In order to see. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so obviously, you know, Golden Dawn was first place. They had the most stars last year. They had the most this year. The Black Wolves had the biggest improvement because they went from negative 50 to 101. Understandable. There's a couple of little details here and there that are kind of interesting, like the fact that the Silver Eagles were one short of the Golden Dawn's record from the previous year, so they were kind of closing the gap until Yuno came along. The Blue Rose Knights, you couldn't see their record from the previous year, so when they say, oh, we went up one rank, you can't really tell by how much exactly, but it was by a fair amount, like it was somewhere between 6 and 13. So they actually did have an improvement in, like, performance with the improvement in rank. Crimson Lion Kings, they went down 17 points because of the absence of their captain. The Purple Workers went down 27 points because of the absence of their captain. Understandable.
You mean the betrayal of their captain.
The betrayal of their captain, so that's understandable. They probably had some stars taken away because of that shit. Praying Mantises stay in the same spot, but they went up. They had 8 more stars, The Aqua Deer went from 7th place to last place because they actually had 4 fewer stars. They're the only guild that had fewer stars that didn't have a captain be absent.
Hmm.
So there you go.
I wonder what that's meant to imply about the Aqua Deer.
It's like entirely possible that because their captain is really young, so maybe he took them over recently.
Very possible. Huh. Like the Mantis guy makes a joke about, like, how all you do is draw dog pictures and you'll do anything, and he's kind of childish, but it is weird to be like, what are you guys the last, like, what makes you guys the last place? I know nothing about you guys. You're the new Black Bulls, essentially. I should be following you guys.
So, but one interesting thing, and the entire reason that I'm actually sharing all this stuff with you is because in my findings, one thing that stood out to me was the guild that had the highest improvement in terms of pure, like, stars earned, aside from the Golden Dawn and the Black Bulls, was the Coral Peacocks.
Hmm.
Which we know the least about, because if you remember the meeting of the captains, we saw, the Aqua Deer's guy was the one who put, the Purple Orca's captain in the painting magic in order to stop him. All the other captains were ready with their magic in order to take action. We've gotten the backstory for Charlotte. We've gotten a little bit of a glimpse of the Praying Mantis guy in a previous battle. And of course we know the Golden Dawn and the Silver Eagles and the Crimson Lion Kings and all that stuff. We know jack shit about the Coral Peacocks because their captain, Dorothy, this girl in the hat, was asleep for like the entire meeting. Didn't do anything. At all. We don't know what magic she does. We don't know anything. And somehow, they improved by a significant margin, and we don't know why.
That is interesting. There's got to be a reason behind it, otherwise why make the point of it?
Yeah, it's because it's just fairly, because they improved, went from 51 to 67, so that's an improvement of about like 30%. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So,
Rose up from the cellar of things too, because I assume they were last place beyond the Black Bulls.
Right, they went from 8th place up to 7th place. So yeah. Oh yeah, so I'm interested to see exactly what the hell was going on with their group, which I'm kind of surprised that there's that going on, and I really hope that it's not just like a meaningless detail. I don't think it is, but
we'll have to see. We're still not at that point where it feels like most of the side captains are all that significant yet, especially mm-hmm. the ones like kind of on the lower card.
Right. Now, we've been very kind of gradually getting introduced to them, because we had the community captains before that, you know, Nozel showed up and we saw Fuego Leon get a bit of focus and stuff like that. And, Vengeance got the, conversation that happened with Yami. So yeah, if anything, I think that honestly, like the other guilds have been like what has gotten the most gradual build up in this entire series. Now that I think about it.
We're still getting there.
Yeah. So the Black Bulls get to soak in their victory a little bit. And then we cut over to a figure in the shadows getting ready to come out on the stage. Who's like, ah, there's a lot of excitement for me, a sideshow. Now greet me with your loudest cheer, citizens. The Royal King of the Clover Kingdom has arrived. And I'm like, there's a king aside from the Wizard King? Oh, okay.
Yeah, like the Wizard King's just the strongest king,
right?
Or the strongest mage, so there's an.
It's like how the Leaf Village had the Hokage, but then it also had like
the what, Daimyo.
Daimyo, I think. Yeah. Which it makes sense, you know. You've got your like ruling class, and then you've got essentially the leader of your army.
Yeah, general, whatever you want to call them.
But this guy coming out of the shadows is just kind of like, I don't really care.
It'll be interesting to see who he is, because I imagine he could be a very significant character. Based on his tone, it seems like he's kind of a pompous dickhead, and because Asta is still established to be on stage, I wouldn't be shocked if he turns out into an asshole. Asta probably will kind of front him.
And the Black Bulls go back down to negative 50 stars, because Asta decides to go after the king.
It is also, worth noting that if you are in one of the countries, you have a Jump subscription, you are able to vote in a character poll for Black Clover. Maybe this is the first one? No, this can't be the first. I guess it's the second character popularity poll for Black Clover that's occurring in Japan, and they're going to basically, like with My Hero recently, they're going to run a simultaneous one over here in America, or English Jump, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And see the results for that. So if you want to, it's viz.com/bc-poll, and there's a big list of characters you can pick from, and there's an option at the bottom to just, like, write in your vote. I will note, Rebecca is not included, because she's not an important character, so there's no possible way that she can end up winning anything.
What is the greatest troll pick do you think that people could make for this series?
Unohana. Honey mustard.
Honey mustard. All right. Let's go on to One Piece. Chapter 862, Cerebral. The first couple of pages are very much just kind of like, hey, in case you forgot what these characters were up to, this is what's going on.
Want to real quick just make mention of the cover page, which is one of the requests
of Buggy and cover page. Shanks.
Well, this is kind of interesting to me. So it's Buggy and Shanks when they were members, they were essentially like, cabin boys on Gold Roger's crew. And we are seeing a glimpse of a couple other characters who, I don't think we've seen before as members of Gold Roger's crew. And these could be throwaway characters that we'll never see again. But knowing Oda, he tends to put these little details in there and use them later on. So don't be shocked if at some point down the line, they run into a fucking talking alligator who was a member of Gold Roger's crew.
Who knows? Especially with the way the fact that, you know, Oda tends to draw a lot of animals on these, so it might not be.
I wonder if it's supposed to be Gold Roger himself behind them. I didn't pay much mind before, but that does
I think it might be, because it does kind of look like him with a mustache. It's really hard to tell.
That's very interesting if that's the case, because we haven't seen drawings of Gold Roger very frequently.
Nah. I mean, he's got the same sort of mustache, and he does look very important based on, you know, the clothing he's wearing, but it is really hard to tell because he's very small in the drawing.
Yeah, it is tough to tell, but it is, I thought it was a cool little detail. Yeah. Also, I don't get what the fuck they're playing when all the cards look different on the back.
It's a trading card game, obviously.
Oh, okay.
So, Jinbei is struggling to wake up Luffy. They're still inside of Capone's fortress. Sanji is posing, with pudding, and you see them, you know, like being all lovey-dovey while they're each, you know, got very different inner thoughts going on. And, the head chef, Big Mom's head chef, pulls out the wedding cake, which is large. It's very large. It looks like a castle. In terms of both design and in size. And there's also one layer, which is a graveyard.
Yep. Yes, there is.
Okay.
I feel like taking a piece of it definitely is going to fuck up my calorie count for the day.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to, you know, do like a full on vertical slice, I mean, in order to like have that be manageable, you would have to be remarkably thin. So, and the altar they're actually going to be on is actually on top of the cake, which is pretty crazy. That's actually kind of clever, you know, mm-hmm. Instead of having the two figurines on the wedding cake, it's just the two of them.
That is a nice touch.
So Big Mom, of course, freaks out. It's like, oh, perfect. So it looks so good. They actually, you know, get pudding and Sanji are being carried over on their cloud thing in order to get on the altar. Big Mom is thinking, all right, it's almost time for the slaughter show. We cut over to the Vince Smokes table and they're being pretty damn ignorant. You know, they're talking about, it's like, oh man, that's Sanji. She's going to marry a hot girl. Eh? And Rage is like, we're really freaking surrounded here. We're in a very convenient spot to be attacked, but okay, cool. This is it. Sweet.
It's just like the Red Wedding, Nick.
But she is concerned because she's thinking, yeah, Sanji's kind of in trouble. Can I really leave this up to Luffy in order to make sure that he gets away? We go up to the altar to see this fair... Of course the priest looks fucking weird. What is with his hair?
It's that body shape that I don't get. It's like hunchback, but then he like flows down like a Christmas tree from there. But his neck, yeah, it does seem to like be pressed down to like lower than shoulder level.
So, easily leads through the proceedings. We cut over to Luffy's group Luffy is munching on a big old chunk of meat while he's running to get into position. He's like, come on guys, we're out of time! yep. Then, as the, you know, as the priest gets to, you know, to love and to cherish until death do you part, everyone looks up and they're like, why is pudding collapsed on her knees? And, older son, whose name I forget, the guy with the,
Jellybean guy.
Jellybean guy, yeah.
Something, I don't remember. Yeah.
He's knows what the hell's going on here.
Katakuri. That's it.
Yeah. And, so I just like, all right, I'm going to be lifting up your veil. And, so pudding is like, all right, that's it, Sanji. Come on and get a good look at my hideous third eye. And, yeah, the veil's up stuff. She stares him with all three eyes and Sanji reacts in surprise. And she's like, yeah, that's it. Just be grossed out by me. And Sanji's like, what a beautiful eye. And Pudding suddenly starts crying. And she's like, what? And, we get a, you know, montage of flashbacks and she goes back to, you know, grabbing her face and being collapsed on the ground. And she's thinking, no one has ever said that this eye was beautiful since the day I was born. And she, it's flashbacks to even her own mother saying, like, oh, even as your mother, I gotta admit, you're creepy! You should grow your bangs! Gross! her siblings reacting that way, everyone around her kids bullying her, until she went and fucking freaked out and, stabbed them in retaliation. And, from that day on, I guess, decided no one will laugh at me without a fight. I'm going to go after all of you and eliminate you all. And, so she's really freaking out in the present, of course, because she's always been seen as this gross, ugly three-eyed monster. And, Sanji was his self.
Why is she some gross, freakish, hideous monster because she has a third eye? But this fucking, like, priest with his shoulders above his head is just like, will you now breathe, man and wife? Everyone's like, well, no, he's handsome and he's in a beautiful way. But you.
He's gotta have a lot of confidence to pull off that hairstyle.
Freakish woman with a perfect 10 body who just happens to have a third eye, usually disguised by her bangs. You should just burn. Like, I bet, like, it's like that scene in Forrest Gump, like, they're all throwing rocks at her, chasing her away, and the fucking priest is one of those guys, like, get out of here, you freakish monster! We don't want your hideous monster kind over here! Ooh, a frog! And his tongue just, like, shoots out and, like, snatches it up.
I mean, despite that, I still like this, because it's like, it's just kind of what you expect with Sanji, isn't it? Like,
it's actually very important that this does happen. One of the things that's been very kind of lost about Sanji as time's gone on and he's kind of just been devolved into the base joke of like, her women, was that he used to be a very smooth person and he used to know how to talk to women. And we came to know that he's got a good heart to him. It's just often lost in his own libido that he just sees like hot women. Spent a year with a bunch of dudes and essentially, like, reached the point of, like, almost not knowing how to interact with women. But it does make sense that Sanji wouldn't be callous, and he would actually be very genuinely kind of, like, moved by someone he found beautiful, and he doesn't seem to actually have very particular things on what he considers that. Like, he's not a very, like, prejudiced person, unless it's, like, a old lady, basically.
Well, we also got a little bit of the same stuff with Viola, in the previous arc, where, you know, she saw that, yeah, he just really loves women.
Yeah, it's a notion, though, that this does feel very appropriate to Sanji, and this has been something that's been very heavily discussed online since this chapter was released, because a lot of people, in different, you know, podcasts, through Twitter, even in our chat room, are kind of talking about how there's a lot of distaste over what essentially happens here, because we haven't gotten the full end of everything, but it definitely seems to indicate some small, at least, level of a face turn for Pudding. At least a sense that her sinister nature is kind of a product of being treated like a monster as she grew up. And that Sanji being the first person to ever treat her normally has been something very moving to her. And this kind of harkens back to a couple flashbacks we got way earlier on in this arc that were sort of like the counter argument to the theory that, Pudding wasn't evil, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So this does line up with that. But what a lot of people are having issues with is that this has kind of become yet another like attractive female character in One Piece who kind of falls into the same role that attractive female characters take in these sorts of arcs, i.e. Rebecca, i.e. Canis, i.e. Vivi, just like the character who towards the end of this kind of cries and just doesn't have much of an active role in things anymore.
It is definitely something that, especially recently, we've seen, where, yeah, it definitely, if there is a attractive female character, then they're kind of not allowed to just stay evil. It happened with Baby Five too. She was like the one person.
Oh yeah, Baby Five is another.
And Doflamingo's entire crew who decided to, you know, ally herself with the good guys at the end. There were some people who were part of, you know, like side crews, you know, like Bellamy and stuff. But she was like a big member who had been with the family for a long time, and she turned on them because she fell in love with a man. Yeah, there was stuff with, you know, Fiello, with Rebecca, think the last time we had like a traditionally attractive female character who stayed evil was Monet.
No, Nick, she had freaky bird legs, not hot at all. Ew, gross.
Some people find... Okay, if you're gonna say the three eyes means that you are disgusting and are gonna be repelled by her, I think that most people could... And she didn't even have a form where, like, I don't even think she had a form where, like, her face got all ugly. Like, or bird-like or anything. So.
She didn't have that, but when she used her Snow Lugia power, she did, like, take on, like, a monstrous kind of form. But it was quickly, she was defeated also in one attack by Zoro, which probably didn't help things a little bit as well. But no, I do get what you're saying. Like, Monet is probably one of the few that it feels in, and that was, like, a mini arc. And she was, mm-hmm. like, the third tier villain in that group, even of that. Now, she had her moments, so that's fine. But it's a situation here that I'm not saying if I'm on either side of this, but I do see where people are seeing the pattern here and why it can be frustrating.
Absolutely. It's something that I definitely feel where I like this in a bottle, but I'm not sure if you can take it in a bottle, considering that this is an ongoing thing and this is a trend that seems to be very consistent over the course of a very long series.
It's the thing that's kind of tough with One Piece in general is it has definitely issues with its with the way it writes its women. We made a lot of jokes about it, particularly when we did that roast bonus podcast. That was kind of like one of the big jokes about One Piece. It didn't know how to write women or draw them. But it is a legitimate problem that One Piece has as a series in that, although it is a cast that generally the side characters get a lot of support, the female characters don't tend to get as many opportunities as the males, and there's a lot less diversity in the designs in the women as well over the course of the series. It's somewhat forgotten in the fact that One Piece is a very well-written series, so even this situation here that this happened, I think this is a well-written kind of twist. I think I would have liked more if Pudding was just evil, and it does insinuate more that Mom's organization is a very, like, wholeheartedly devoted organization and not just, oh, Mom's a bitch to everybody, even her own kids. But it is this idea that even though this is well-written, even though it's, you know, enjoyable, it is one of those things where you'd kind of hope at some point someone would say to Oda, hey, maybe we should try mixing things up a little bit here. Maybe someone else. And I do have some ambition that that'll be the case in the Wano arc, since I think maybe Monosuke will be the one to kind of fill in this sort of role in that. But then again, he has a fucking dragon devil fruit, so who knows? Maybe he'll become a badass. I don't really know. It's just one of those situations where One Piece does so many things really well. I can see why a lot of people just like wish they did this one aspect as well as it does everything else.
And it's also, you gotta consider like, kind of a difference in cultures. So
I think, when you compare it to the other manga in Jump right now, I mean, One Piece is one of the few that actually gives its female characters like their own screen time and fights. So there is that aspect to it, but it's also then what are you willing to accept as, like, the appropriate level of, you know, feminism marching on or whatever you want to phrase it as.
Right. Okay, so let's wrap things up because we've got a couple more pages to go through. So people are like, what the hell? She was supposed to shoot Sanji by this point, so Big Mama's like, all right then. She gives a quick signal. Okay, Priest, you shoot him instead. It's like how the fucking Priest is just picks out a gun. But Karakuri is like, it's no good. He's going to dodge it. So he flicks a jelly bean towards Sanji instead to do the job. But Sanji dodges it, and the jelly bean kills the Priest instead. Or hits the Priest instead. I don't know if it actually kills him.
I would assume it does since it's a gunshot, but that would be... That would be a very cold fucking murder at that point. What do you think that insinuates? Do you think maybe Sanji has color of observation hockey?
I think he's just a badass.
Very possible.
I don't know. So they're like, all right, that was the signal. They get to move on. The Vince Smoke start to freak out because they're like, what the hell? Someone shot the Priest. Katakuri stands up. Big Mom's freaking out. And Karakuri's like, this situation is unpredictable. Even I can't act to control it. The cake suddenly starts to swell, and it bursts open, and a whole bunch of Luffy's pop out, eating cake, flying through the sky. Everyone's like, what the hell?
I have no fucking clue what is happening.
Well, there was that one guy in the woods that, could
change
people's appearance.
That is right, Pound. Or no.
So.
No, it was, that was Brulee that made clones of them. She made like mirror copies of people, right?
I thought that it was like, animals that were disguised in them, wasn't it?
Well, it was Seducing Woods. I can't remember what the fact actually did that. I thought it was Brulee.
Well, no, wasn't it that, cause they acted like animals, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think she can mirror appearances onto other things, so she just mirrored the appearances of the characters onto animals.
Right, so she, And she does have a freak out in this chapter where she's like, I'm sorry, they forced me to do it.
So. Okay, so I guess that's what she's saying.
Okay. So that's the chapter. It looks like we're finally at the point where the rescue plan is being put into action, and I am looking forward to seeing how this goes down.
Yeah, I like this chapter by and large. Again, I still think I would have liked more if Pudding had stayed evil. I just think it would have been a little bit more fun if the Big Mom organization felt like this evil empire without many cracks in it beyond Lola and the two other outlier kids. But this still works. It's had its proper build up to it. The idea that there isn't nothing but evil inside of Pudding, that there might be something more, it fits with Sanji. It's nice for him to have this moment. I think it's also very cool that he just has that moment where he just dodges Katakuri's jelly bean and he's just like
a badass.
Fuck. He just killed a dude. I'm pumped. I'm eager to see what happens, with the next chapters.
All right, let's name our favorites for this week as we wrap things up.
All right. My chapter of the week, I think I'm going to give to The Promised Neverland. This was a really, really big chapter. I like the way everything was kind of explained and delivered upon, and I like the climax we kind of got to at the end of things.
Okay. I'm going with that as well. It was a nice little an explanation of what's going on. It was, really cool and, left me really excited for what's going to happen next because it seems like big changes are in store for the series.
That there is.
And, Promised Neverland, got a tie? No, just one. Someone just put it over the top. So, in the audience poll. So, put that down. It was very close between it and One Piece, however.
Yes. And I could see that from both sides. I'm trying to think of my character MVP is. I feel like I had one, and it's gone now. So, in lieu of that, fuck it, Taijo from Dr. Stone.
All right. I'll go with Sanji. Okay. Because he had a cool little character moment, and he also looked like a badass. So, but they're really important. Yeah, there were a couple of different moments, this week where I thought, oh, that's really cool. They got to do that, but, I almost went with Phil, but, yeah, let's go with Sanji. Alright. So, that is gonna do it for Weekly Manga Recap, so we want to thank you guys for joining us. We record the show Wednesdays normally at about 7 PM Eastern Standard Time here on hitbox.tv/RealLT and twitch.tv/RealLT. But sometimes we do need to change things up. Schedule it for a different day, in case something happens. So in order to stay updated on that stuff, you can follow us on social media, on Twitter. The podcast is, at WMR Podcast, and you can follow your hosts at Realty and at Wide Ruler of Time. So special thanks go out to our supporters on Patreon. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We are planning on, putting together the bonus podcast very soon. Just a few days ago, we did the Q&A episode for the month. Not sure if that's available yet.
Yep, it's up. It's up on iTunes, Podbean. So if you want to listen to it, you absolutely can. And by the way, We haven't announced it officially on the podcast itself, but our bonus podcast for this month is going to be a top 10. We're going to be counting down the top 10 quote unquote best dub openings. The dub openings that were not just a translated version of the original, one that they created essentially an original piece, and the ones that feel the most like the people who were licensing it were not really sure what was going on. They were just like, this is kind of cool, right? This is what, who cares what the tone of this series is? Or let's just make this as silly and goofy as possible. There's a ton of great ones. These aren't all necessarily going to be bad ones. Some might be enjoyable for those reasons, but there are definitely going to be some interesting picks for that, and you're definitely not going to want to miss that one. It seems like it's going to be a lot of fun. That should be out, I believe, this weekend, too, because I'm going to be gone after that.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we also want to thank Steve Mann, our talk artist. You can check out his work in a bunch of different places. He does some of his stuff is NSFW, so be aware of that whenever you're browsing his stuff. And, yeah, Infinite Planet as well. He does a little bit of stuff to make the visual editions of this. And that's about it, I think.
Yeah, I think that's more or less going to do it. I have nothing else to really follow this up on. Oh, Nick, did you hear the big news? Aaron Hernandez is going to be out indefinitely with a neck injury. That's the podcast, everybody.